Good day, and welcome to the Trust for America's Health Ready or Not conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Rich Hamburg. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Rich Hamburg, Interim President and CEO of Trust for America's Health. Thanks for joining us today for the release of Ready or Not, Protecting the Public from Diseases, Disasters, and Bioterrorism. We first released this report in 2003 in the wake of September 11th and the anthrax tragedies. Over the past 13 years, between Ready or Not report and a companion report we've issued called Outbreaks, we've documented progress that has been made and identified remaining gaps in the nation's preparedness for health emergencies. This report was supported by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and is available on TIFA's website at www.healthyamericans.org. State-specific information is also available on our website for every state. I'm pleased to be joined today by Eric Toner, Senior Associate, UPMC Center for Health Security. Dr. Toner is one of the nation's leading experts on hospital and healthcare readiness, and will talk in depth about health preparedness and resiliency. I'll start the call by providing an overview of the report, hand the call over to Eric, and then provide a short conclusion before we take questions. Overall, Ready for Not report finds that the nation has an inconsistent approach to preparing for health emergencies, which creates a situation where we are often caught off guard when new threats arise, such as Zika or the Ebola outbreak or bioterror threat. And then, to be able to respond, we end up having to scramble, diverting attention and resources away from other serious ongoing health priorities. And then after the sense of emergency dissipates, we once again become complacent, cutting funds, programs, and the trained public health workforce perpetuating this cycle. Over the past 15 years, we've watched this pattern of ramping up, followed by complacency and cuts, which undercuts the progress that has been made, followed by the need to rapidly ramp up over all over again when the next emergency happens, thus often rebuilding abilities that have been lost and built, or built and lost. We aren't adequately maintaining a strong and steady defense, and the result is that we consistently see health emergencies disrupting, derailing, and diverting resources from other ongoing priorities and efforts from across government, in addition to leaving Americans at unnecessary risk. Over time, the report tracked significant progress, but also remaining vulnerabilities that were never sufficiently addressed. On top of that, we've begun to see the backsliding of some advances as budgets were cut on a number of occasions. For example, after years of cuts to public health capacity to detect and control mosquito-borne diseases, we saw the first domestic cases of Zika virus, which puts babies of infected mothers at risk for serious complications. The Ready or Not report provides an overview of public health preparedness issues and policies, and it features a state-by-state review of 10 key indicators of preparedness. Each year, we develop these 10 key indicators to assess health emergency preparedness capabilities in states. These indicators reflect some important areas of preparedness, which, taken together, offer a composite view of strengths and vulnerabilities in the nation's health security. The indicators represent a snapshot of important areas of health emergency preparedness and are developed in consultation with leading public health experts based on data from publicly available sources or information provided by public officials. It is not a comprehensive analysis, but we feel it's important to conduct this report each year because we believe the public deserves to know how prepared their states and communities are in responding to public health emergencies. The scores are not intended to serve as a reflection on the performance of officials at specific state or local health departments, since they reflect a much broader context, including resources, policy environments, and the health status of a community. Rather, the report identifies where sufficient action has been taken to support adequate public health preparedness and where improvements must be made to overcome obstacles to achieving a solid baseline of preparedness to protect every American, no matter where they live. Overall, a majority of states, 26 in the District of Columbia, scored 6 or lower on these 10 indicators. Massachusetts scored the highest with 10 out of 10, and 2 states achieved 9 out of 10, North Carolina and Washington State. The lowest scores were 3 out of 10 in Alaska and Idaho. So for a summary of some of the specific indicator findings, first, for funding, 26 states either increased or maintained funding for public health from fiscal year 2014/15 to 2015/16. On basic capabilities, 30 states and Washington, D.C. met or exceeded the national average score on the National Health Security Preparedness Index, which looked at key aspects of being able to effectively detect, diagnose, contain, and recover from health emergencies, such as the ability to distribute materials from the Strategic National Stockpile to maintain the emergency operations centers. Also on the subject of basic capabilities, only 10 states vaccinated at least half of their population against seasonal flu. That's only one out of five states during 2015 to 2016. The CDC recommends everyone over the age of 6 months old to be vaccinated with a goal of 70% vaccination rates to help protect the population. In recent years, there have been between 12,000 and 56,000 flu-related deaths in any given year. It can vary based on the severity of the strain each year. A significant number of cases of the flu and flu deaths could be prevented each year with vaccinations. This indicator also helps examine how well the country does and the infrastructure we have in place to be able to rapidly vaccinate the public in the case of a major new disease outbreak. For foodborne illnesses, 45 states in Washington, D.C. increased the speed that they can detect cases of E. coli, which is a measure of states' ability to detect and respond quickly to foodborne illnesses and outbreaks. Every year, foodborne illnesses are responsible for around 128,000 hospital visits and 3,000 deaths. For healthcare readiness to respond to major health emergencies, only 10 states have a formal access program or a program in progress for getting private sector healthcare staff and supplies into restricted areas during a disaster. During a disaster, access and reentry of critical healthcare personnel and supplies is essential. Yet, most states have disjointed policies for permitting private sector personnel and supplies into disaster sites, which can delay care at a critical time. For the full list of indicators and each state's scores, they're all available at www.healthyamericans.org. In terms of overall trends we've seen over the past 15 years, there are some major areas of accomplishment, including improvements in emergency operations, communication, and coordination. Increased support for the Strategic National Stockpile and the ability to distribute medicines and vaccines during crises. Major upgrades in public health laboratories and foodborne illness detection capabilities and improvements in legal and liability protections during emergencies. But, as I've mentioned before, we've seen a cycle of major cuts over time and a cycle of needing emergency supplemental funding to backfill gaps in basic capabilities beyond what is needed to cover new needs for a particular emergency. Health emergency preparedness funding for states has been cut by one-third, and healthcare preparedness funding has been cut in half over time. Some of the ongoing areas of major gaps include lack of a coordinated, interoperable, near real-time biosurveillance system, insufficient support for research, development, and stockpiling of new medicines, vaccines, and medical equipment to keep pace with modern threats, and issues with the ability of the healthcare system to care for a mass influx of patients during a major outbreak or attack, and then finally cuts the public health workforce all across the states. I'll now turn the call over to Eric, who's a senior associate at UPMC Center for Health Security. Eric?
Thanks, Rich. Hello, everybody. As Rich said, and as the report demonstrates, our nation simply isn't as prepared as it could be for public health emergencies. And while the health system is better prepared than it was before 2002 when the Hospital Preparedness and Public Health Emergency Preparedness Programs were created, recent emergencies have shown that persistent gaps still exist. Specifically, as Rich noted, there are still issues with medical surge capacity, with baseline funding to train responders, and declining public health workforce. Every year, we are losing a tremendous amount of expertise and boots on the ground. Major disasters, along with almost daily smaller ones, are becoming ever more frequent. At the same time, over the last decade, we have seen there have been major ongoing changes in healthcare, especially the consolidation of hospitals and physician practices and outpatient facilities into large integrated healthcare networks. While this is not necessarily bad, it does create problems for the way in which we imagine the healthcare system to be best prepared. So as the healthcare landscape evolves, our understanding of the intersection of health and disasters has also been evolving. And this evolution presents a unique opportunity to shape the future of public health preparedness. With the support of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, over the last year, the Center for Health Security has interviewed scores of experts and hosted meetings with thought leaders and subject matter experts. And we've learned a lot from these interactions, and I'll try to summarize some of our findings here. While it may seem basic, it's worth underscoring the fact that different types of disasters stress the healthcare system in different ways, requiring us to be nimble and prepared for all kinds of hazards. In natural disasters, for example, most of the patients who present for care are not direct casualties of the event, but rather people with chronic health conditions who have been displaced from their normal sources of care. And the most vulnerable in our society, those who are most likely to have pre-existing conditions, are also inherently the least able to be resilient due to lack of resources and supports. Therefore, quite often these patients end up in hospital emergency departments, and these departments are not well prepared to deliver the kind of care these people need. For example, think of an elderly, low-income person with diabetes on dialysis who relies on public transportation. When her dialysis center closes or medication runs out, she's likely to end up in a hospital emergency department, which has little capacity for outpatient dialysis and might be understaffed and have limited beds available. At the time of a huge stress, this surge of patients further stresses the hospital and degrades the care for both the patients who need to be in the hospital and for those who would be better served elsewhere. To that end, our nation's health sector preparedness space must be broadened. For events that have long impacts and large geographic footprints, the stress on hospitals could be lessened if the rest of the health sector were more resilient, if clinics, home health providers, and all other entities that support public health were better prepared to resist the stress of a disaster and could quickly bounce back. The entire health sector is tightly interrelated and codependent, so a lack of resilience on any one part places an added burden on the whole. And this ties into the next major theme which we heard, which is really to be prepared for an emergency. We need a broadly resilient communities. As our recent hurricanes demonstrated, many segments of society are not adequately prepared, and this includes utilities, transportation, supply chains, etc. To be able to preserve health and save lives after disaster, many sectors of society, other than just the health sector, need to be resilient. For years, the focus of preparedness has been on hospitals and public health and emergency management, and this makes sense and is an obvious place to start, but it's now clear that our foundation for preparedness must be broadened and focused on making our communities more resilient. In line with the strategy of the Hospital Preparedness Program, new partners must be recruited to join the healthcare coalitions. And beyond that, community-based organizations that work on many other important health issues should be encouraged and incentivized to include aspects of disaster resilience in their missions. Lastly, what we've been doing so far hasn't gotten us to where we need to be, so we need creative grassroots solutions. Finding ways to create public, private, and philanthropic partnerships that promote greater resilience requires creativity and flexibility. In our project, we've seen encouraging examples of novel approaches to disaster health resilience. In Boston, where they have a chief resilience officer who has a background in public health emergency preparedness, and in Cedar Rapids, where multiple community-based organizations work together to improve resilience to flooding, and in Los Angeles, where the health department has developed metrics and applied a rigorous quality improvement methodological approach to improving resilience. Letting a thousand flowers bloom may be a needed approach during a time of major shifts in healthcare policy, which involves increasingly frequent disasters. This Ready or Not report helps outline why the nation must incentivize these types of innovative partnerships and improve resilience of our communities. So with that, I'll pass the mic back to Rich.
Thanks a lot, Eric. Really appreciate that. In closing, some thoughts here. The Ready or Not report provides a series of recommendations that address many of the major gaps in emergency health preparedness, including requiring strong, consistent, baseline public health foundational capabilities in regions, states, and communities so that everyone is protected. While it's nearly impossible to be 100% prepared for all emergencies, there are core basic capabilities that experts agree are necessary and can be maintained to better protect the public from a range of possible concerns. Ensuring stable, sufficient public health emergency preparedness funding to maintain a standing set of foundational capabilities alongside a complementary public health emergency fund, which would provide immediate surge funding during an emergency. Improving federal leadership before, during, and after disasters, including at the White House level. Recruiting and training the next generation, or a next generation, public health workforce with expert scientific, critical thinking, and management skills to harness and use technological advances and serve as the chief health strategist for a community. Reconsidering health system preparedness for new threats and mass outbreaks by developing stronger coalitions and partnerships among providers, hospitals, insurance companies, pharmaceuticals, health equipment businesses, emergency management, and public health agencies. Prioritizing efforts to address one of the most serious threats to human health by expanding efforts to stop superbugs and antibiotic resistance. And then finally, improving rates of vaccinations for children and adults, which are one of the most effective public health tools against many infectious diseases. Simply put, a modern and stable biodefense requires refocusing public health departments, healthcare and resources to more effectively use workforce, emerging technology, and strategies to achieve better outcomes and results, and better protect Americans from new and ongoing threats. A strategic modern biodefense also yields strong returns. Investing in prevention and effective response capabilities helps avoid costs in dollars and lives lost. With that, let's go ahead and open the call for any questions. And just a reminder that the report and its state-by-state materials are available at TIFA's website, www.healthyamericans.org.
And ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question over the phone, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. We'll take our first question from Andrew Siddons with Congressional Quarterly. Andrew, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, thank you for doing this. I'm wondering what your outlook is for any, you know, of these issues you've outlined to be addressed, you know, by the next administration and in the new Congress. You know, what kind of appetite do you think there is from the new, you know, appointees at HHS and incoming Republican leaders to address any of these gaps that you've outlined here?
Well, you know, I think a lot of these issues are up front and center after the Ebola outbreak, you know, we've seen the Ebola outbreak and then subsequent outbreaks this year. The problem that we're seeing here is that we've seen a steady decline in resources, you know, a true complacency that's manifested itself in having less resources available at the hospital level for public health departments at the state and local level. We even saw during the outbreak this year that we had to redirect funds when emergency funds were not available as soon as they were needed, and you know the time that it took Congress to act on this outbreak was sufficiently longer than in the past. So, you know, what we're looking at now is the concept of an emergency fund. You know, we know we have dollars, you know, annual dollars that are appropriated, and then at the tail end, Congress often acts with, you know, large sums of resources that the president approves for emergency supplementals, but we also feel strongly that we need a permanent public health emergency fund, an expedited emergency spending when a crisis arrives. You know, governments need immediate flexible funds to respond to crises, and I think that's something that this new Congress and administration should and I think will pay a lot of attention to.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question from Lisa Schnuring with SIDREP News.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. Your group is in a unique position to look at patterns over the last decade or so, more than a decade. Just wondering if when you took stock of everything this year, if anything really unusual jumped out or there were any surprises in what you found. Thanks so much.
Well, you know, I think, big surprise was how long it took to react to this year's outbreak. And, you know, I think that it really focused attention on how unprepared we are in addressing various emergencies, outbreaks, whether they're weather, infectious diseases, and, you know, it focuses on the importance of these additional resources. You can't take emergency funds and hire staff. We're talking about foundational capabilities, by foundational capabilities, we're looking at surveillance, epidemiology, promoting and improving health, adequate interoperable communications, cultivating leadership, demonstrating accountability. I mean, these are all things that need resources moving forward, and the idea that in the middle of an emergency we have to wait 8 to 10 months to respond to a Zika outbreak, and that's the outbreak I was referring to, is really unacceptable. I don't know if Eric has any.
Well, Rich, I agree absolutely with what you say. Preparedness is like insurance, or preparedness is like a fire department. It requires regular funding, regular commitment, and no matter how hard you try, later on, if you haven't built the foundation, you can't respond effectively. So, in adding on to the first question, I would say, preparedness, being able to protect lives and protect the public's health should not be a partisan issue. And I would think that any Congress or any administration would take this issue seriously.
And as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, it is star one if you would like to ask a question. Star one. We'll take our next question from Tom Averill with Philadelphia Inquirer.
Thank you. You talked about the response to the Zika outbreak this year and that it took 8 to 10 months to respond. Could you be more specific? What are you talking about? And how fast should we have responded? And what do you mean by respond in this context?
I'm referring to emergency supplemental funding, and we've seen significant dollars appropriated for emergencies, from the major hurricanes that we've seen to the flu pandemics, and in the report we show the amount of days that it took Congress to provide the necessary funding, and this is significantly longer than in prior emergencies.
Okay. So it took 8 to 10 months from the time of what?
I think the time that the seriousness of the outbreak was evident. And it was such a long turnaround time that existing funds that had been previously allocated for the Ebola outbreak were moved around to address Zika. Ebola is an ongoing problem that we're monitoring and addressing on an international stage. So, I think it just calls attention to the importance of the recommendation in the report about having a permanent public health emergency fund, at least as a bridge between ongoing annual funding and what often ends up being a significant supplemental federal appropriation.
Okay, thanks.
We'll take our next question from Margarita Cambest with the York Dispatch.
This is a question for Eric. You mentioned that the types of patients who may present at a hospital after a natural disaster might not be the I guess, proper type of patient that's best served at an emergency department. What type of disaster would a hospital be better prepared to serve? Or what type of disaster patient would a hospital be better prepared to serve?
Well, you know, hospital emergency departments are designed and prepared for taking care of people with acute and severe illnesses and injuries. So, you know, people from car accidents and shootings and stabbings and heart attacks and things like that. Hospital emergency departments are not well prepared to take care of people who need prescription refills, have chronic health conditions that require routine outpatient care. Those are the kinds of people who are most often seeking care in hospital emergency departments after disasters. At least large natural disasters. The number of actual victims who need medical care tend to be relatively limited, but the number of people who are displaced from their ongoing health care is very large. So we saw in Hurricane Sandy and previously in Hurricane Katrina and many other natural disasters that the remaining health facilities become overwhelmed with people who need prescription refills, who need their blood pressure checked, who need their diabetes managed, who need dialysis. And hospital emergency departments are not well prepared for that. And so the effect is the people don't get you know, the quality care that they should, and the people who really need the hospital emergency department, the people with heart attacks and other acute injuries and illnesses can't get the time of care that they need. So what we were trying to say is that, you know, if the rest of the health system, if clinics and outpatient facilities were more resilient, if they were not taken offline by the disaster, the whole system would work better.
So more like infectious disease or terrorism disasters going to the hospital and then other outpatient clinics being able to support natural disasters.
Yeah, but not exclusively. You know, in natural disasters, we need emergency departments too, but we need the rest of the system to be more resilient.
And we'll take our next question from Rachel Pace with WBUR News.
Hi, thank you. I'm not sure which of you is best equipped to answer this, but I was surprised that only one state was found to be ready on 10 out of 10 indicators, and I'm wondering if you could speak to why Massachusetts is better prepared, you know, what they might be doing that other states aren't.
Yeah, this is Rich. We've done this report for a number of years. We've had various indicators that have remained the same over the years, but more often than not, we've really raised the bar. We've been doing this for 13, 14 years. So by raising the bar, you know, we're really looking for, you know, greater and greater levels of preparedness at the state level. So, for example, Massachusetts met all 10 indicators this year, but, you know, met seven of them in our prior sister report, so to speak. And so we've seen some consistency among the states, but, you know, I think there's been a lot of movement, and I think the movement is reflective that a report like this is taken seriously, that public health emergency preparedness is a high priority, and you know, I do think that this report helps raise that bar and you know, have some healthy competition, so to speak, among the states. And you know, we've been really pleased when we've tracked certain indicators over time to see, you know, only 10 or 15 or 20 and eventually 40 or 50 being met. And then at that point, we end up, you know, raising to another level. So it's a snapshot. You know, not surprisingly, with a wide set of indicators like this, not every state is going to meet every indicator. But, you know, I think it does send a signal, you know, to the states, to to policymakers, and that's, you know, I think really what this report is aimed at, that that there are certain capabilities that all states should have and should strive to achieve.
So there's no one particular change. I mean, I know you said that there have been a lot of changes made, and I think it was you earlier that had mentioned the city preparedness director in Boston, but is there anything that sort of differentiates Massachusetts from other states at this point? I mean, I guess why is there only one that met all the indicators?
I mean, I don't know if I have a specific answer to that. We can get back to you with some specific information around Massachusetts after the call, but nothing jumped out at me. But, you know, I think historically it has been a state that has taken public health capabilities and emergency preparedness capabilities, you know, very seriously.
Okay, thank you.
We'll take our next question from Michael Hewson with the Columbus Dispatch.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, great. So you were speaking earlier about strengthening, and on the state level, I'm just kind of curious. You talked about policymakers and Congress quite a bit, but how much of this kind of is on the shoulders of, you know, the state itself, or is it more like state policy or community and grassroots building, or is it a combination of all that?
Eric, want to take that one on?
Sure. You know, it's everybody's responsibility. You know, individuals have some role, but certainly cities and towns have a role, and states do as well. And I think that, you know, this report is mostly looking at capabilities across the states. You know, the government provides funding. The federal government, that is, provides funding and guidance. But the states are the ones who carry out these functions. And, you know, some states take this very seriously. I think probably Massachusetts is one. Others don't prioritize these things as much. But I think that everyone has a role to play, and everyone is responsible for making their communities better prepared.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We'll take our next question from Shemaine Mills with Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi. Thanks. I have a multi-part question. First of all, have you always looked at the issue of climate change? What are the criteria? And some in our state, in Wisconsin, would be amazed that we got a B-. So I'm curious what the criteria were. Thank you.
Yeah, this particular report, let me get you some details on that. So this particular report is looking at the effects that, for example, extreme weather events are having. You know, these are major implications for health. And, yes, for the last couple of years, we have had climate change-related indicators. You know, different regions of the country face different health threats due to climate change. It could be sea level rise, flooding, drought, hurricanes, severe weather. You know, we do know that increased numbers of mosquitoes, ticks, and other insects that carry infectious diseases can rise in warmer temperatures. So this was an independent report done by Climate Central and ICF. We can get you some further details as to you know, what they were measuring, but basically the report card addressed the changing characteristics of five climate-related threats, and I think that if you're talking about emergency preparedness, you have to be thinking climate change, and that has to be one of the indicators. So, you know, we talk about outbreaks, bioterrorism, food safety. I mean, there are a number of different I think people would be surprised to think about the number of different kinds of emergencies that that a state and local health department needs to address, but this is definitely one of them.
As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, it is star one if you'd like to ask a question. Star one. We'll pause briefly. And we'll take our next question from Storm Jones with KGOU Radio.
Yeah, thank you. What should the message be to states that scored poorly on this report? What should states be taking away from this?
I think that start with the word complacency, and this is a message to the public, to policymakers, that you know this is long term, this is not short term, and you know we've seen accomplishments, but we know there are a lot of ongoing gaps. So you know if I were a state, you know I would think you know do I have real time biosurveillance? Have I put sufficient support into research and development of new medications, vaccines, and medical equipment? You know, are there gaps in my particular healthcare system? Are we adequately prepared for a mass influx of patients during a major outbreak? I mean, I think that's the key is surge capacity, ability to respond to a major emergency that affects a broad range of the population, then some of the issues that Eric addressed around resiliency. You know, how resilient is a community to rebound from an emergency like that? So I think it's a combination of, gee, what are some major accomplishments that others have achieved? You know, has my state achieved this? So I went through some of the gaps, but talk about some of the accomplishments that this report highlights. There are states with improved emergency operations. There are states that are adequately or more adequately prepared than others to distribute medicines and vaccines during a crisis. We look at laboratory capacity. Over the years, we've seen some major upgrades in public health laboratories in their ability to respond to emergencies like foodborne illnesses. So, you know, I think it's an educational piece. As we say, it's a snapshot that the public, the policymakers, health professionals can look at and say, you know, what can I be doing better long term to improve the resiliency of my particular community.
Thanks.
And with no further questions at this time, I'd like to turn the call back over to Rich Hamburg for any additional or closing remarks.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate everyone being on the line. Don't forget to go to healthyamericans.org, and we do have a lot of additional helpful background materials, including state-by-state information. And if you have any questions, you know, please contact us. And thanks for Eric Toner for participating in this call as well. Much appreciated.
You're very welcome, Rich.
And that will conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation, and you may now disconnect.